When you sit down in a theater to watch a play, you almost never think about the script itself. You just, watch the actors moving around the stage.
Right, you're just watching the story unfold.
Yeah, they're saying their lines, hitting their marks, and you kind of just assume that's the natural flow of things, right?
Exactly. I mean, the words on the page are essentially invisible to the audience at that point.
You're experiencing the performance like it's reality playing out organically in real time.
Right, you completely forget the architecture behind it.
But I mean, if an actor suddenly trips over a prop or just completely refuses to say a line, that illusion shatters instantly.
Oh, totally.
You're abruptly reminded that, hey, someone wrote this interaction. Someone designed this whole scenario.
And everyone on stage is just playing a part, and they were handed, long before the curtain went up.
Right. Well, welcome to today's deep dive. For you listening, we are looking at a script that we have, well, we've all been handed. One that society has basically been acting out for generations without really realizing it.
But this script obviously isn't for a stage play.
No, it's this incredibly comprehensive 71-lesson educational course by Hey SSL, and it's titled Rewriting the Narrative, Challenging Social Myths and Accountability Patterns.
Yeah, and the authors of this course provide this really profound look at the architecture of how we communicate about harm. The core mission of this material is to basically unpack how violence and harassment against women absolutely do not happen in a vacuum.
Right, it's not random.
Not at all. The authors argue that these actions are entirely shaped by the stories, the narratives that society tells about who is responsible, who gets believed, and crucially, who is ultimately blamed.
And the goal of our deep dive today isn't to, point fingers or assign personal blame to anyone listening. It's actually the exact opposite, really.
It's about seeing the matrix, so to speak.
Exactly. It's to help you recognize these hidden societal scripts. The course wants us to understand how deeply these narratives influence human behavior and ultimately, how we can actually start to rewrite them.
Which is such an empowering way to look at it.
Okay, let's unpack this because the text starts by looking at the very foundation of how we're raised to view safety. And it presents this massive paradox about why our standard everyday advice to just, stay safe is actually failing society spectacularly.
It's a really fascinating paradox to explore because if we examine the earliest messages society feeds children, those messages set the entire psychological foundation for how they'll view responsibility later in life.
Decades later, yeah.
Exactly. The source material points out that from a very early age, girls in particular are handed this really rigorous checklist for simply existing in public spaces.
The classic safety rules. Things like cover up so you don't distract anyone, or don't walk alone at night.
Always hold your keys between your fingers when you walk to your car.
Right. I mean, it creates this constant ambient hum of risk management.
It really does.
Reading through how the course frames this, it's like we're all essentially living in a house with a massive hole in the roof.
Oh, I like that analogy.
Right. But instead of fixing the leak, society is spending years aggressively training half the residents to just perfectly dodge the raindrops.
That captures the dynamic perfectly. I mean, society offers this high praise to the individuals who are best at dodging the rain
Right.
while just completely ignoring the fact that the floor of the house is still flooded.
But okay, I want to push back on the course's premise here slightly, just to look at the other side of the coin.
Sure, go for it.
Aren't parents and teachers just trying to be protective? Like, what is inherently wrong with teaching caution in a world that we objectively know can be dangerous?
Well, that's a very common reaction, and the course actually explicitly validates that point.
Okay.
These messages almost always originate from a place of deep parental care and genuine fear.
Right. They mean well.
But if we connect this to the bigger picture, the authors argue that focusing entirely on how potential victims should avoid danger doesn't actually stop harmful behavior from occurring.
It just moves it around.
Exactly. It simply redirects the behavior.
Meaning the danger doesn't vanish, it just finds a different target.
Precisely the argument. If one person successfully follows all the safety rules, they avoid harm by taking a different route or changing their clothing, the person intending to cause harm doesn't suddenly abandon their intent.
They just look for someone else.
Yeah, they simply move on. And often that means targeting someone who is less prepared, younger, or maybe more vulnerable.
Man.
Yeah. The course suggests that this framework inadvertently turns safety into this sort of zero-sum competition.
Wow, yeah.
And on a psychological level, it sends three highly dangerous subliminal messages to young minds. First, that harm is simply an inevitable force of nature.
Like the weather.
Exactly. Second, that safety is entirely a personal responsibility rather than a community baseline. And third, that the risk fundamentally belongs to women.
While at the exact same time, boys are receiving a completely different script regarding their own behavior.
Oh, entirely different.
The text contrasts those rigid safety checklists with phrases like, you know, boys will be boys, or, oh, he's just teasing you because he likes you.
Right.
According to the course, this creates a massive foundational imbalance in cognitive development. Society basically places the entire burden of managing social behavior onto girls, while rarely teaching boys to take internal accountability for their actions.
Which is wild when you think about it.
It is. So before an incident of harassment even occurs in adulthood, the psychological stage is already completely set for who society will instinctively blame.
Which logically explains why, when harm does happen, the immediate societal response is this barrage of questions directed at the victim.
Right.
Because the burden of prevention was placed entirely on them from childhood, the constant threat of harm just becomes completely normalized in adulthood.
It is expected.
Yeah. The source material refers to this as the background noise of harm. And they argue that it creates a really heavy culture of silence.
Yeah, because when a threat becomes routine, human beings adapt by just ignoring it to function.
Right.
And the text points out a very specific, incredibly common phrase that perfectly captures how numb society has become.
Oh, this part was so revealing.
Think about the last time you sent the text, text me when you get home safe, to a friend. You send it out of love, I mean, we all do.
Of course.
But the course asks us to look at the invisible weight of that text and how it casually reinforces the problem.
It is a brilliant example used by the authors because it is just so well-intentioned. But underneath the care, the phrase subtly reinforces the learned idea that navigating physical danger is simply a normal part of the victim's job description.
Right, like it's just expected.
The danger is treated like bad weather, an unavoidable environmental hazard that you just have to dress appropriately for.
Yeah, exactly.
Consequently, when harm actually occurs, instead of society asking what drove the perpetrator to hurt someone, the immediate default is to ask, well, why was she walking there?
Or why didn't she just leave the situation?
Exactly.
And the question of why didn't she leave is something the source tackles head on, specifically regarding abusive dynamics.
Right. They really break that down.
Yeah. They break down the statistics, pointing out that leaving is mathematically the most dangerous moment for a victim. Trying to exit the dynamic risks severe escalation, physical retaliation, or even the loss of housing and basic financial stability.
And reframing those complex, really calculated survival responses as poor moral choices is a major theme in the curriculum.
Yeah.
The authors emphasize that staying in a situation or, you know, just laughing off inappropriate comments at work, those are survival tactics.
Absolutely.
Women learn very early on that reacting strongly to ambient harassment every single time is not only psychologically exhausting, but often professionally or even physically dangerous.
It's just too much.
So they minimize the harassment because functioning in society requires them to constantly downplay the severity of it. This raises an important question. If victims are constantly forced by these societal scripts to minimize their own harassment just to survive the workday, how does that minimization fuel the bystander effect?
That is such a good point.
The course dives deep into this, explaining that public silence inherently breeds more silence.
To understand the bystander effect as the course presents it, we have to look at the psychological mechanism known as diffusion of responsibility.
Right.
When human beings are in a group and they witness something ambiguous or uncomfortable, our brains instantly look to the crowd for social cues.
We look to see what everyone else is doing.
Exactly. If everyone else is quiet, the brain assumes, well, there's no emergency. When bystanders witness harassment and freeze, whether out of fear or uncertainty, or maybe the assumption that someone else is more qualified to step in, it sends a very clear, chilling message to everyone involved.
Yeah, it signals to the perpetrator that their behavior is socially acceptable, or at the very least, that the community isn't going to challenge them. And critically, it tells the victim that the world is watching them be targeted and actively choosing not to help.
That is so heavy.
It is. The authors argue this dynamic is the direct pipeline to why victims don't speak up after the fact. The narrative often suggests victims are apathetic or maybe making it up, but the course argues they stay silent because they fear immense backlash, professional consequences, and just institutional disbelief.
And who can blame them?
Exactly. And the text makes a point to acknowledge that this calculus of risk is magnified exponentially for individuals with less systemic power.
Like younger women?
Younger women, women of color, or disabled women. For these groups, silence is never compliance. Silence is a highly calculated act of self-protection from a system that routinely punishes anyone who causes social discomfort.
Wow. Yeah, if we follow the course's logic that victims are forced into silence because the system fails to protect them, we then have to look at the other side of the equation.
Right, how the system actively protects the perpetrators.
Exactly. Here's where it gets really interesting, because the Hezel-SL course highlights a massive, glaring societal contradiction when it comes to how our culture views men's capabilities.
The curriculum calls this the anatomy of the excuse, specifically examining the he didn't know better narrative.
The text points out a massive paradox here. Society disproportionately trusts men to run global financial institutions, right? To make incredibly complex geopolitical decisions and hold the vast majority of institutional power.
Yeah, we trust them with everything.
Yet, simultaneously, when a man crosses a clear personal boundary, the cultural script completely infantilizes him. Suddenly, the narrative portrays him as being too confused or socially unaware to understand basic human empathy and consent.
Right.
The authors ask, I mean, how can both narratives possibly be true?
The course argues that they cannot be true simultaneously. It identifies this as cognitive dissonance designed entirely to protect the status quo. The mechanism treats basic human respect as if it's some kind of advanced, hyper-complex emotional intelligence that men simply cannot be expected to grasp.
Like it's calculus or something.
Right. And the direct result of this framing is that it shifts all the emotional labor back onto women. It becomes women's implicit responsibility to educate the men around them, to draw the boundaries with perfect clarity, and to just constantly offer grace when those boundaries are ignored.
Wow.
Through this lens, a lack of accountability is completely rebranded by society as a mere lack of understanding.
And the authors argue that the media is highly complicit in reinforcing this specific rebrand. The course includes this really fascinating deep dive into media literacy called the assumption dump activity.
This part was eye-opening.
It forces readers to look strictly at the mechanical construction of news headlines. The premise is that headlines frequently strip the humanity out of these stories, replacing human impact with, you know, decontextualized statistics and passive phrasing, which fundamentally dulls our emotional response.
Yeah, the language choices in those headlines trigger specific cognitive biases in the reader. The course breaks down the evidence by categorizing headline language into two distinct buckets. First, you have victim framing cues.
These are the details injected into the story that focus on what the victim was wearing, right?
Yeah.
Or whether they had been drinking alcohol or the fact that they were out late at night.
Exactly. And the psychological mechanism at play here ties into the just world fallacy.
Right.
It's the human brain's desire to believe that bad things only happen to people who make bad choices. Now, none of those details legally or logically cause an assault.
Of course not.
However, as the course points out, they act as subtle cues to the reader implying poor judgment. They invite the audience to silently calculate how much the victim is to blame, which basically makes the reader feel safer by comparison.
It's a defense mechanism.
Totally. Then the course identifies the second bucket, perpetrator softening cues.
The authors spend a lot of time on the use of passive voice here, arguing that it's a linguistic trick. Like, headline will read, woman was assaulted, rather than man assaults woman.
Passive voice is incredibly effective for obscuring responsibility because it completely removes the actor from the action.
Yeah.
The reader visualizes the outcome, but not the person causing it.
Mm.
Alongside the passive voice, the course highlights the insertion of humanizing status-based details about the perpetrator.
Oh, right. Like, headlines frequently refer to the accused as a star athlete.
Or a promising medical student.
Or a devoted father of two.
Exactly.
The text argues that this subtly teaches audiences who is believable and who possesses a future that is worth protecting. It makes the violence far easier for society to digest without ever having to challenge the broader institutional system.
It softens the blow.
Yeah. Like if you read that a promising college athlete made a mistake late at night, the linguistic script is telling your brain exactly how to feel about the scenario, that it's just a tragic anomaly rather than a systemic failure.
Which normalizes the harm. And the course's ultimate point in this section is that when harm becomes normalized, systemic accountability entirely disappears.
Yeah.
Institutions feel far less pressure to implement real change, and survivors are left to manage the psychological impact completely isolated.
So what does this all mean? We've mapped out the matrix here. We see how the course believes these narratives are constructed from the ground up, you know, from childhood safety plans, dodging raindrops, all the way to the cognitive biases baked into our evening news headlines.
It's a lot to take in.
It is. And I can easily imagine the listener thinking, okay, I see the script now, but I'm not a public activist. I have a normal corporate job. I have a family.
Right.
How do I actually change this deeply entrenched system in my daily life without starting a massive screaming fight at the dinner table every single night?
It feels incredibly daunting to confront societal architecture.
It really does.
But what's fascinating here is that the course explicitly advises against massive confrontational arguments.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The authors argue that real, lasting cultural shifts do not usually begin with sweeping legislation or screaming matches. They start with small, consistent, low-conflict disruptions in our everyday language.
Okay, I like that.
The psychological premise is that most people aren't acting out of deep malice. They are simply repeating the script they absorbed since childhood. When you interrupt that automatic cycle smoothly, you create a space for internal reflection rather than triggering defensive posturing.
To that end, the course dedicates significant time to a practical toolkit. These are actionable, highly realistic shifts.
Right.
One of the primary tools they introduce is called flipping the script.
Flipping the script is a highly effective way to bypass someone's natural defensiveness. You simply take the logic of their statement and reverse the genders or the context to expose the underlying bias.
Without attacking them.
Exactly, without ever directly accusing them of being biased.
Let's look at a practical application of that. Imagine a coworker or a relative says, well, she was walking home alone in that neighborhood. She really put herself in that situation.
We've all heard that.
The course suggests you don't need to yell at them or call them a misogynist. You just ask a calm, clarifying question. Like, if a man walks home late from work in that neighborhood and gets mugged, do we blame him for being there?
So simple.
It hands the exact same logic back to the speaker. It forces their brain to process the double standard on its own terms.
Another crucial psychological tool the course advocates for is making conscious language shifts, specifically moving away from phrases that minimize impact.
Right.
A common scenario is when someone makes a deeply inappropriate comment and a bystander defends them by saying, oh, he was just joking, he didn't mean anything by it. The course provides a specific counterphrase, intent doesn't erase impact.
The authors really focus on how humor is constantly weaponized as a shield. It blurs the line between harmless banter and actual harm, training people to swallow their discomfort just to avoid ruining the social vibe.
Oh.
Replying with, intent doesn't erase impact, is powerful because it validates that the person might not have intended to be malicious while simultaneously holding them completely accountable for the damage the words caused.
It dismantles the just a joke defense entirely.
And breaking that habit of silence doesn't require some dramatic, cinematic showdown in the office break room. The source material heavily advocates for what it calls low conflict callouts.
Let's role play how that actually works. If someone makes a questionable, minimizing joke in a meeting, you don't have to launch into a lecture on patriarchal structures.
Right. No TED Talks required.
No TED Talks. You can literally just tilt your head and ask, what do you mean by that? Or
right.
I don't get the punchline. Can you explain it?
Psychology behind this is brilliant. The course points out that sexist or minimizing jokes rely entirely on unspoken shared assumptions.
Yeah.
The second you force the person to explain the bias out loud, the joke falls apart and the awkwardness is transferred back onto them rather than onto the target.
Alternatively, the course suggests simply stating that didn't sit right with me and moving on. The goal isn't to win a debate. The goal of a low conflict callout is simply to signal to the room that the behavior is no longer considered neutral.
It's setting a boundary.
Exactly. The authors stress that consistency is the key metric here. Every single time you question a harmful assumption or actively choose not to laugh at a minimizing joke, you are essentially setting a new neurological baseline for what your social circle considers acceptable.
You're literally editing the societal script in real time.
Yeah. Cultural change, according to this material, happens purely when the everyday mundane norms shift.
So for you listening right now, perhaps you're a survivor who is just now realizing through the lens of this course that your silence over the years wasn't a personal weakness. It was a highly learned, incredibly necessary survival skill in a system stacked against you. Or perhaps you're an ally who just wants to be significantly better at spotting this harmful framing in the news media and interrupting it in your own social circles. Recognizing the mechanics of these narratives is your ultimate shortcut.
Really is.
It's the shortcut to being a far more informed, more deeply empathetic member of society who isn't just blindly reading the lines they were handed.
And to wrap up our analysis of the Hey SSL material, it feels vital to leave you with one final, perhaps provocative thought derived directly from the text.
Okay, let's hear it.
The course reminds us of a fundamental sociological truth. What we have collectively normalized is not natural. It is entirely learned behavior. And anything that is learned can, with intention, be unlearned.
Wow.
So if the way we talk about safety, blame, and accountability has been so deeply and carefully manufactured, you know, built brick by brick through passive news headlines, childhood rules, and diffusion of responsibility, what other massive systemic inequalities in our daily lives are we currently accepting as just the way things are, simply because we haven't thought to rewrite the narrative?
It really makes you wonder what else is hiding in plain sight, just waiting to be questioned. Because once you finally see the leak in the roof, you really can't unsee it.
No, you can't.
And eventually you have to decide if you are going to spend the rest of your life dodging the raindrops, or if you're finally going to grab a ladder and fix the house.